All right, thanks a lot. It's 7 o'clock. Today we'll be featuring on If Music Could Talk, the poetry and also works, musical poetry of Steve Dalashinsky. And I've got an interview here that I'll be playing excerpts of. Also be playing selections from Incomplete Directions, which is a CD that came out a few years ago. And then also Phenomena of Interference. All the links to those CDs, information, whatnot, are on WRIR.org right now. So I'll be posting more information in the future. But we'll be playing all kinds of poetry and also discussing it today. And this is the part of my show where music and poetry kind of converge in a weird gray area. And we'll just have to see just how musical words can be. So let's start it off here. And this is If Music Could Talk on WRIR LP 97.3.
Hello, everybody. This is Steve Dalashinsky, and you're listening to If Music Could Talk on WRIR. In a bio that I mostly send out to people, I was born somewhere after the last big war and had to survive lots of little wars.
Yeah.
You know, there's never been a time where I've been on Earth where there hasn't been a war. I was born right after World War II. I went right into the Korean War. Not me, but I mean, I grew up with the Korean War and the Cold War, and then there was the Vietnam War and tons of little wars. So the Iraqi War is just another, in this case, since I'm alive, other than the Vietnam War, the biggest blemish on American history while I'm on the planet.
Yeah.
But the thing is,
and then you can go back to the Columbus.
Exactly. You see, that's the point.
There's that other poem on that same CD, Columbus.
And Columbus never stopped.
Yeah.
Well, did he?
Yeah.
This great 84-year-old woman who plays the piano, when she did one of the pieces you and I talked about.
What's her name?
Stephanie Stone. She's the one who plays on the one Columbus Never Stopped Here.
Yeah, yeah.
When she said to me, what's the poem about? That's, you know, pretty much what anybody said during any of the sessions, what's the poem about?
Yeah.
And in her case, I said it's about America, and she just started playing America the Beautiful. She didn't even think twice.
Yeah.
And that's, I think, one of the most beautiful tracks on the CD, and basically because she just played America the Beautiful, and it just worked.
The rain has stopped for us today. The sun comes out at sunset. The wind brays sweetly through the now pale onion flowers, open to a new diversity. The sounds of equivalence and rhyme. But it is still and always will be true. Columbus never stopped here.
If you were to write an anti-war poem then, if you were alive, in more vague terms rather than immediate about certain particular people or whatever, then it would still have relevance today, you know?
I would
hope
so.
Just writing from an anti...
Well, sure. It's like, I think if I was writing poems during the Inquisition, I'd certainly be talking about the injustice of and mental illness of people using...
Group mentality.
Yeah, group mentality, and using so-called God that nobody even knows exists name in order to murder lots of people, just like with the Crusades, but...
That would still be relevant today.
Of course. See, that's a problem. It would still be relevant today, but I don't know if I would have said, you know, Queen Isabella or whoever at the time who was running Spain went around murdering lots of people during the Inquisition and all the other places they were murdered. I don't know if I would write specifically about those people. What I would write about was all the that they're doing, and say that, God, you know, in 6 AD, they did the same.
Yeah.
And the audacity that they had to do it.
Yeah, the audacity that they had and have, you know. I mean, so it's basically the same audacity. I mean, the reality and almost the ridiculousness of something like Iraq is that we're in there in a small country with all these useless big weapons, and it's like with Vietnam and other little wars we've decided to get into, those little guys, we have a murderer mentality, but we don't have a terrorist mentality.
Right.
So we've...
Well, I don't know. Some people say, you talk about racism, and they say you can only be a racist if you have the power to oppress someone.
Uh-huh.
And then I guess to be a terrorist, maybe that speaks of a mindset too. I mean, terrorists, you would think, would come from a country that's not being considered as a political force, but it's the same that the army would do to a people. But it's not called terrorism for some reason. You know?
I mean, when people say George Bush is the biggest terrorist of all, I don't disagree with that. It's just that it's a different kind of terrorism.
Don't look for tragedy. It's right here where you left it, in the amphitheater, surrounded by a chorus of music and words and misunderstanding. Kazan said, when one person is right and one is wrong, that's melodrama. When two people are right, that's tragedy. When we Democrats decide just to enjoy ourselves in quake and in flood, our story will be easier to handle. Consequence, consideration, sequential relationship. This is hip. This is a jazz poem. Run it through your fingers and play it, say it. This document of heat. This is a jazz poem. Covered in circumstance, circumference of oh, roundabout, head trip, cooler than tonight, into nebula hotness. It's it. This thing called free, so enjoy yourself. It's more than about time. This is testament, monument, concrete elusiveness. Make it happen, this book of ice, bartered like a crisp winter morning, a tale in the back of her head, tales told in the unturned pages, frozen for all to see, beneath itself in a case of encrustment. A jazz poem, a book of ice, one foretells the other, preclude, exceed. The flame jumps into my hand on this mad, sad occasion for happiness. We dwell in the pages and our cheeks redden and swell. This is what we came here for, not to remember, not to be forgotten, to enjoy ourselves, to be recorded in the book of ice, like Daniel, like Crest, like Monolith, like Tomb. A jazz poem. Have you heard this? And does it make you laugh and sneer and comment and cry and be poem? A book of ice, pages dried by an unflamed fire, wet and torn and bent and philosophic. A gallery of misanthropes and authors and artists stuck together by this thaw, clearly bleeding into each other's hands. This is a Where Have You Been and Back Again essay. The club, the store, the market, the place, the gallery, the haven, the lie, the ballast, the blast. Here was not yesterday. We sat and dreamed and tried to remember the notes, the chords, the letters we wrote to each other. Pressed hours between the pages, smell gone, but a structure to remind one of origin, where we stem from. This is the organ of knowledge. A jazz poem? A leg wet from the splash of a passing crime. A plate glass window on a meaty street. This is hip. A jazz poem. A bagel with cream cheese. An overpriced slice of us, of what we think we are. If we enjoy ourselves, then our story will be easier to take. Swallow, history, tragedy, logo, theosophy, democracy, immediacy, oligarchy. Get drunk and anything sounds good. Don't cry yourself to sleep. Don't think about the ultimate highest jazz poem. This is a jazz poem, a book of ice. Trust has nothing to do with it. Get drunk. Get drunk. We gave it to us to take us away. We murdered the night with music and with growling. We will not be forgiven. It's all here in the book of ice, but the pages are worn and frozen. Your turn. They cannot be turned. They can only listen to your reasons, wrinkled and unmoving. This is a jazz poem. No, you'd better think again.
So this book of ice, then, back to that.
We can't turn the pages, Carl, just like I said the other time. It's all there for us to see. Who the hell knows it? It's all there for us to see if we could only open the pages up. And the pages are kind of like the blinders on our eyes, you know. Well, you can't open the pages because I say they're frozen for all to see, but can they be thawed out? I doubt it. Because then again, if you thaw them out the wrong way, they're just going to fall apart from the weight of all that water, you know. You won't be able to see a damn thing anyway.
Yeah.
So for me, these two metaphors from watching this great film on Greek history, which became American history, white American, European history, and this thing of the actuality of these books, they became... You know, because I never thought of it until this second, but most of those books that were given to me were philosophy books, and which I was going to sell on the street, actually.
And they froze in this.
And they all froze. And, you know, The Owl's Legacy is about the Greeks and the foundation of Greek, aside from their pseudo-democracy and, you know, feeding people to lions and whatnot. one of the foundations of Greco-Roman history, besides murdering people, was philosophy.
Right.
You know, so, you know, coincidentally, the two of them collided with each other, and I got five poems out of them. We don't live in a democracy we never have, that the Greeks never have, even though they invented the term, that we've always lived in, as they did, in an oligarchy, and even if we vote on who leads us, they're the ones who lead us, and they do everything in our name, like start war, you know. I really believe, I mean, I could be wrong, because maybe people are that fluffed up, but I really believe if people voted on the war in Iraq, that there probably would not be a war.
Right, but we don't vote on a war.
No.
We elect the people who decide to go to war.
Exactly. We really almost don't vote on anything. We vote on lots of little things, But all the major decisions that change our way of living, from destroying the ecological system, which we're just as responsible for in the long run, but in the greater sense, it's really the few that rule the many. I mean, it's not. I mean, that's just the way it is. So, when I said when we Democrats learn to enjoy ourselves in Quake and in Flood, I think I was actually making a joke. That
you're talking about Democrats as people who live in democracy, rather than versus Republicans.
Yeah, it has nothing to do with Republicans. It's about a politic, not politics. It's about what I meant by we Democrats, that if we were all, as humans, Democrats, not in the political sense, but in what, how I translate that word, we would be free human beings in a free society.
In Incomplete Directions, you were saying some people never read the signs pointing to infinity. You know, there's two styles of looking at the world, and some people never look to these signs pointing to infinity.
It's more eternity than infinity, because they're two different places. Well, for me, that poem is one of the most important poems I've ever written in my life. There's a lot of mystique in the poem, but one of the things, and I won't mention the guy's name, even though he's dead, because he's one of my favorite poets, but he and Kerouac, and especially this guy in some poem, I don't remember, they just threw around the word eternity too much, you know. I just know that I wrote it for my friend Bernard, who I love dearly and haven't seen in a long time, who's, like I said, lived in Switzerland, and he was questioning life a lot, and that's why I said this new year of ours is, you know, and this new direction we're walking will be the same in just one way. When we get to the end of the street, we'll just keep walking. So, this guy who wants to find eternity keeps asking for directions, and the guy just says, just keep walking, because, I mean, what else can you tell a guy looking for eternity?
Yeah. There's a difference between that guy, your good friend here, and a lot of people who never seem to have any worries or problems or any problem with, you know, life, because they're not waking up every day and seeing that those...
I envy those moments, Carl.
Yeah, ignorance is bliss. Some people never read these signs pointing in that direction of, okay, well, what's going to happen next? Where's all this leading to?
Mm.
And,
where is it all leading to?
Yeah.
To write eternity on a piece of paper is so easy. Then everything else follows. Walls, shadows, dreams, death, life, gurus. Signs that say keep off the grass. Signs that say don't feed the birds. Signs that say not too fast. Signs that say not so slow. This new generation of ours, already grown old. This new year. Nothing. When I asked the man for directions on how to get to eternity, he said, just keep walking, and then you'll come to the end of the street. And when you get to the end of the street, just keep walking, and you'll come to the end of the street. And when you get to the end of the street, just keep walking, and you'll get to the end of the street. And when you get to the end of the street, just keep walking. You get the idea. To write eternity on a piece of paper is so easy. Then everything else follows. Poets, drunkards, lovers, flowers, paranoids, ceilings, bombs, toilets, answers, fingers pointing, picking noses. To find eternity is very hard. To be eternity is very hard. Signs that say stop, you are now approaching eternity. Signs that say Eternity is just around the corner. Signs that say school crossing. Signs that say at the end of this street, eternity. Slow down, no alcoholic beverages. No unnecessary noise. Don't feed the pigeons. Don't squeeze the squirrels. At the end of this street, eternity. Then just keep on walking until you get to the end of this street. And when you get to the end of this street, just keep on walking. Circles, doormats, windows, mirrors. Spoke to yourself in your mirror. You decided to change by changing the course of the street. That's okay. This course we've walked is dead. But we keep walking. The new course will be similar to the old in just one way. When we get to the end of the street, we'll just keep walking. But maybe we'll stop. Stop searching, stop walking, sit down and rest and kiss and talk and hug and fight and love and die and never once mention eternity. When we get to the end of the street, we'll stop, maybe even turn around if it's not too late. That's nice. It's nice to look for something that's hard to find, but such bullshit to write it down. Nothing pretty or romantic about this poem. Nothing at all to read. These signs that say more signs. Danger, slippery, falling rock zone, deer crossing, sharp turn, heaven, hell. So easy to write heaven on a piece of stone. The old, tall, thin, gray man in the old, tall, thin, gray suit came toward me, arms out, beckoning, holding in his left hand a small gray card and saying in a thin, sharp, gray voice, I don't want to die yet. I don't want to die yet. I don't want to die yet. I turned and ran in panic to the white living room, slammed his fingers in the door, slammed the covers over my head. Easy to write death and then eternity follows. As easy to run away or walk to the end of the street and just keep walking. Maybe if we reach the river, we can take the stone and drop it in.
The one line in that poem that personifies what we're talking about is, you know, there's a lot of funny things, falling rock zone, don't squeeze the squirrels, you know. Unless I'm in a foreign country that doesn't understand English, don't squeeze the squirrels gets a laugh all the time. Why I put that line in there, I don't know. I think some of those lines probably came out from me sitting in the park and when I wrote the poem in the cooler. The squeeze the squirrels, feed the pigeons, the whole idea of what we can't do, don't do this,
can't,
don't do that.
Can't do.
I mean, I should have written just a poem of that. Don't. And it's a good idea. Maybe one day I'll do it if I remember to, you know, because if I wrote a don't poem, it would be perfect because if you do it right, the public will love it. Wow, man, that's a fantastic poem.
Well, you could write a book of commandments, too, for that matter. I
mean, right, thou shalt not squeeze the squirrels. The line in there that personifies what we're talking about is a line that simply says, signs that say more signs.
Hmm.
Because that's the whole thing. It's all about surface.
Yeah.
So,
and it's not really pointing anywhere.
It's not pointing anywhere. It's just telling you where the next item is on sale.
Yeah.
Or if we're going to get down to that base level.
Sure, sure.
You know, I mean,
in Manhattan, you're overloaded with directions. Go here,
right.
Go there.
Right.
So,
you know, I was just in Tokyo, and you're overloaded there, too.
Oh,
you know,
even more so, probably.
Yeah. So
they're flashing over there in neon.
Totally. Totally, you know, I mean, you're overloaded in most big cities, and I've only been to very few of those big cities, but I've been to a couple that are based on overload. You know, Paris is based on overload, even though it doesn't want to look that way.
Right,
but New York is completely based on overload, and the idea of signs that say more signs is exactly what we're at, you know, and it's odd because now you keep making me feel like I have to reference the Book of Vice all the time because signs that say more signs. We're always talking about reading.
Yeah.
We're always talking about some kind of direction. Maybe we'll, by the time, you know, we'll stop, you know, stop searching. And, you know, we'll take the stone and we'll...
drop it in.
We'll drop it in and never once mention eternity.
Yeah.
Which means that...
and just keep walking.
And just keep walking. You know, and I even say we'll stop and hug and kiss and love, which is not so much in my kind of...
religion.
Religion, right. I mean, sure, I think it's great, but I just don't believe in it. But, you know, what I said in that poem is, again... pretty much a reiteration of my entire philosophy because, you know, sure, I don't know whether there's a God or a heaven or a hell, and the reality is if everybody would stop, you know, stop searching, and that includes the people who don't even know they're searching because, like you said, you know, most of those people don't know.
Yeah.
They know they're going to die. I mean, one of the problems about humanity is we're pretty much the only creature that was given the cognizance of death constantly.
Yeah.
So we know it the minute we're able to know it, even if we're little kids and don't exactly get it, we know it real early on. But so it would be really nice, and it would be wonderful if it would be wonderful. I wouldn't care if anybody else did it, if even I could do it. Just stop. You know, we know that what we got is right here and it's nowhere else.
Yeah.
And I mean, the only area pretty much it's ever covered in is art. Where we are now in the Book of Ice is right here. That right here means...
tomorrow, next week.
Yeah.
But also... what
but right here particularly means what pair of shoes should I buy.
Yeah.
You're listening to Music of Talk, and we're having a special interview and, playing some poetry by Steve Dalashinsky. And so thanks for tuning in. This is WRIR-LP 97.3 FM, Richmond Indie Radio. Change the World Shopping at 10,000 Villages, the oldest and largest fair trade organization in North America. Artists and farmers in 32 countries around the world are paid fair prices for their products, helping to end the cycle of poverty. 10,000 Villages offers a variety of handcrafted items like jewelry, textiles, instruments, and home decor. Your purchases offer dignity, hope, and independence for people in some of the poorest countries. For more information, call 10,000 Villages at 358-5170. Or visit their store in the heart of Carytown. The gallery and art, the gallery art and design in Carytown announces their inaugural international photo competition, Colors of Life, to benefit the Richmond Children's Hospital. This is a call for entries for amateur, student, and professional photographers alike. Submissions are due September 1st. There will be cash prizes for the top three finalists and a night gala, awards ceremony, and silent auction at the Jefferson Hotel in early 2007. Exhibit and sell your work while contributing to a worthy local cause. For more information and applications, visit www.the-gallery.it or 804-355-0102. So we're listening to Steve Dalashinsky. I met him actually when I was a delivery truck driver in New York. Back in, I guess, 99 or 2000. And I met him when he was selling books on the street, actually. So always had some good words to get me thinking in the right direction again. But we'll keep it rolling here, and you can let Steve tell you about his work himself as we explain it through this interview.
Talk about work, the men who have jobs. They discuss some aspect of work. Some gossip, some inside joke or technical tour de force. James Dean in a gallery window. We talk about sleep.
Was it out of choice or necessity that you ended up spending that much time selling books in Soho on the street there? I mean, because it seems to fit in really well with And it gives you the ability to kind of watch, do a lot of people watching and interacting with people on the street. That's what I always liked about being out there in the city all day. I mean, was that a choice?
Partially survival, partially, I got addicted to it. I mean, I went out there for a bunch of reasons. I mean, in 76, I went to California, and I wanted to make a little extra money, and I was also already buying lots of records for myself. Like, the Rolling Stones had just reissued all their records in stereo, and I had mono copies, which I was stupid enough not to be an audiophile, so I didn't realize that mono copies were the way to go.
Yeah.
So I got rid of my mono copies and bought stereo copies, and I sold my mono copies to a store, and they gave me very little money. And when I came back from California 2 months later, I don't know why, but I went into the store, I sold them, and they were hanging on the wall for $50 a record.
Yeah, yeah.
And this was in the 70s, so, and I started selling records on the street myself, and very cheaply in most cases, but
right.
I started selling records on the street, and then, I mean, there was a point where I sold pretty much everything.
So it started out with records, though?
Yeah, it started with records, and then some records and books.
Yeah.
And, then I worked for a while across, first I worked on West Broadway, and then I worked across the street on a platform where, you know, I was selling everything, you know.
Yeah.
Records and books were the main thing, records particularly, but I would sell complete junk.
Yeah, yeah.
I did that for a long time, and when I got to the spot where you saw me, I had been to 3 or 4 different spots between West Broadway and Spring Street already, and the guy who worked out there with me, Harry, we were very good friends for a while, and he said, I can come sell with him over there. And there was a store called Urban Archaeology, which let me sell on their ledge, and the landlord used to say things to me like, I don't understand why these guys let you sell here. But he didn't bother me, and they let me sell, and then eventually he let me sell, and I would sell with Harry there, and Harry and I would get into tremendous fights, and that's a whole other story, but I ended up selling in that spot for a very long time until just very recently when they sold the building and told us we had to leave.
Yeah.
But I did it for many reasons, and it became more and more of an addiction, and a lot of times I met a lot of great people on the street,
mm-hmm.
you know, but I also, at the same time, like, you know, I said to Yuko today, I said, you know, God, you know, I miss the street because I like being outside.
Yeah.
Especially when it's beautiful weather and I don't know what to do with myself. But also, I mean, I guess you never did see me, or you don't remember seeing me in a really horrendous mood because the street made me really sick because, well, you know, you could sit out there all day and make no money. You know, I had hundreds and hundreds of books and records in the back and always had this dream, I'm going to get rid of them all.
Yeah.
But probably, you know, I finally did. I literally got rid of them all. I mostly just threw them away. But, and I was surprised I was able to do it. But, so part of it was, sure, to make the money. My means of living is not very difficult. I don't pay these kind of crazy rents people pay, and lots of other things like that, but it was always a way to help me get money, and when I made some money, it was fine, and I'm not a spendthrift, so I was always able to save a little of what I made, but I think part of it really became an addiction, and then a fantasy, like, you know, that I'm going to make a lot of money today, or people are going to come and buy hundreds of $2 records,
yeah.
You know. And,
well, it's really sporadic like that, too.
Yeah. You know, and we would do it, like, blame it on the change in the neighborhood.
Yeah.
But, you know, that was really only part of it. For a good part of it, it was real torture.
Yeah.
But, yeah, and I think I probably should have stopped working on the street a long time ago, like Yuko wanted me to, and I just kept doing it and doing it. And I probably, if they didn't make us leave the space, I'd still be doing it.
Yeah.
I mean, I kind of miss it, and I kept, like, like three boxes of books and a box of records and always have this...
Just in case.
Yeah, I have this idea that, you know, Yuko and I will casually go out on West Broadway every now and then and set up shop for what, I don't know, because I wouldn't expect to sell anything anymore.
Well, the marketplace is like a metaphor, too. I mean, mm-hmm. for a meeting place of people and cultures.
We all have to live somewhere. In my house, in my work, in the music. You live in your house, the street, the music. Give up the body, the sweet smell of citrus on the skin, the innocence of clementine. Go. Go restlessly into numbers. I go openly back to the tree.
Complexion and complexity, you say, you're saying we all come from somewhere. Is this about world culture and diversity in any way? You say we all have to live somewhere.
Right, that's from the Charles Gale book also.
Oh, really?
We all have to live somewhere is from an older poem that I wrote listening to Charles, and he would talk a lot during his gigs.
Yeah.
And he still does it sometimes. And he would talk about separatism, about feeling like he doesn't belong in America, like he's a displaced person.
Yeah.
So the idea of complexion and complexity is that he was also homeless, even though he lived in a squat.
Huh.
He considered himself homeless, and the first album he did is called Homeless, and I was honored to write the liner notes for it, actually. And he's always dealing with that, so the line... We all have to live somewhere, you know, in my house, in my work, in the music. Those are places that I live.
Yeah.
You know, and my work probably meant everything from working on the street to writing poems to being the superintendent of this building, which I was for a very long time. And, of course, the music had become more and more by that point an obsessional part of my life.
Yeah.
And like I said, for him, he has to live in his house, the street, because he always talked about this idea of being homeless, and the music. And because he was so into religion, I think that's where the line, give up the body, comes from.
Yeah.
And I can't tell you for sure, but the complexion refers to being black.
Yeah.
And Charles talked about that constantly. And and I guess it was a good play on words, complexion and complexity. And someone said to me, you know, you write great poems, and I love your long poems, but you said so much in that little poem. And, you know, basically what I said in a very short space is what we've been talking about the whole 2 hours, is that, of course, I won't go willingly back to the tree. But what I'm saying is, you know, that's about as far as we've really gotten. That's how I felt writing that poem, which probably reflected what I was feeling through what Charles might have been doing that night. And he might have talked again about... He went really heavily into the displacement thing about being a black man in America.
Yeah.
And feeling completely, you know, why am I here? And all the rules that are made by white people. And, you know, it was very heavy, and I translated that speech into about a 4-page poem. You know, it's just the same idea, right? As a continual thread through the work about kind of basically came from the tree, apparently. And, you know, when I say I'll willingly go back to the tree, it's a metaphor, meaning, hey, babe, maybe if you clean up your act, I'll clean up mine. but if not, I'll be willing to go eat some bananas and pretend I ain't really causing any problems.
Yeah.
You know?
have a double life, the homeless shaman said. There are two of me. I have two selves. I never use them at the same time. I live in double time. I try not to make it a habit. New York is my nightmare and my dream. It is what is beneath the tracks. Defiled virgin whore, maladjusted transsexual goddess, cross-eyed cross-dresser. Homeless shaman as greasy as the tracks. I am consumed by jealousy, he says. It is my job to carry this burden so that you do not. New York is skeleton and frame. Heaven, hell, tributes and lies. The facts as he sees them. Skyline and light. City of fallen angels. Extinguished stars. New York is nature, mort, landscape and eats. Jesus, Buddha and God. New York lives on borrowed digital time like shaman, leading a double life. The good, the bad, the epicenter, outside the center, outside of time, a part of and apart from America. What is beneath the tracks? Shaman living on outside time. New York is two selves, never the same thing twice, never living together as to not use each other up, body, soul, ripped, greasy, ugly love. New York is what is beneath the self, self, the other self.
Yeah, that's Subway Systems featuring Steve Dalashinsky and also Matthew Shipp. And that came out on Hopscotch Records. So, yeah, check WRIR.org for more links and info. But we'll continue on. This is WRIR-LP 97.3 FM Richmond Indie Radio. You're listening to If Music Could Talk.
Were there times when you felt that you wanted to get out of New York? Because Subway Systems, you say New York is my nightmare and my dream.
Yeah.
And it's a part of America and apart from America. Mm-hmm. And then you're also speaking of these street shaman. Mm-hmm. It's kind of a nightmarish sort of poem that's describing New York as sort of its own vacuum and its own island at mm-hmm. the same time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a fairly recent poem in the last... Well, I was going to say 5 years. Yeah, that's about it, because I'm 99% sure, unless my brain is really playing tricks on me, that poem was written after 9/11.
Yeah.
Yuko and I were on a subway, actually coming from Brooklyn to come back home, and I think it was we went to see some kind of gig in Williamsburg, and there was a guy on the train platform, a black guy, who was completely out of it. I mean, really gone, and he had a beautiful face, and he was really like in a trance, yeah, mumbling to himself, and I still remember him at the edge of the platform, and he became, you know, it was one of those poems when I was writing it, probably almost immediately looking at him or when I got on the train,
yeah,
where I thought, like, I think of a lot of my poems, oh, yeah, you know, this is just down to Earth Bay now, blah, 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 blah.
But you write it down anyway, thank God.
Well, I write it, yeah, you know, I write it down, and I feel that way about it. Most of my poems that aren't experimental, although, like I told you, I can't really be experimental most of the time. I have to force myself to be that way. And I really have grown to love that poem. And I had to actually, although I usually have pretty much control of my own material, I kind of had to fight to get that on the CD.
Really?
Yeah, yeah. They kind of didn't want it on there. I mean, Matthew, after a while, doesn't care one way or the other. For him, it's just a gig. But the kid, the saxophone player whose label it is, he for some reason didn't want that on there. And it was on another CD I did with these French musicians in Bordeaux, and I actually called the CD Subway Systems. But because there was a literally less than a five-second glitch in the live tape, their friend, who they run a small private label, he decided not to put it out because of this four-second glitch, which really pissed me off. So I was determined
to get it on a CD.
If I did a project, I would get it on there because, you know, now it feels like I'm so used to reading it, and people, whether they have ever heard it before or not, in an odd way, are so used to hearing it that it's lost some of its impact for me. But I think it's, for a very down-to-earth poem, one of the strongest poems I ever wrote about the human condition and about New York City in particular. And New York is my nightmare, my dream, and ever since I've been a kid, I wanted to live in France. And I never got to France until I was fairly older, and now I go there once or twice a year for the last 5 years.
Yeah.
And Subway Systems, to me, explores and shows you the incredible magnitude of New York City, but also the claustrophobic small-town quality. And it really is, it's a world to itself, you know.
I dreamed I was Van Gogh in Brooklyn or the Lower East Side. And my folks who thought me touched told me not to go walking in the evening's heavy rain. And my brother and sister also said, take care. Mumbling timidly goodbye, I left the brightly ill-lit flat and climbed down many stairs to reach the ground. I walked the street without a coat or socks, but from somewhere an umbrella held, and with each step taken, the rain increased, as if itself were in some hurry to get nowhere fast. And the day's dark density glowed in moody increase as my shirt and pants ballooned with wet and my soaked through shoes kept parting waves like the Red Sea or a speeding car. I dreamed I was Van Gogh in Brooklyn, somewhere near the Lower East Side, thinking starry nights in the pouring rain to background music, with somewhere the sky boldly, flatly twisting above the solid mass of clouds in blue and gray lightning swirls, lighting a canvas not yet wet, a crazy, sharp space above the false ceiling above me, the palette being laid out in my clean and confused mind. I dreamed I was Van Gogh, all wet and sad and thinking. I dreamed I was Van Gogh.
So you grew up in New York?
Yeah, I was born in Brooklyn.
Yeah, and what part of Brooklyn is that?
I never really figured out what they call it. I guess it was called East Flatbush or the Midwood section.
Yeah.
I went to Midwood High School, or dropped out of Midwood High School, however we look at it, so on.
And would you say growing up there affected who you became as an adult, but then also how did it affect your language and your dialect and your writing?
You know, I always make a joke about it now that, you know, I spent my whole life trying to get out of Brooklyn, and now everybody's trying to get into Brooklyn. And,
yeah.
I guess Brooklyn affected my life in a very deep way, even though maybe most of the time I try not to relate to it. I mean, up until a certain point in my life, you know, Brooklyn was my childhood. It was the only thing I knew.
Yeah.
Outside of my imagination.
Yeah.
And
did you wander around Brooklyn? I mean,
I actually didn't wander around Brooklyn.
Explore it.
You know, when you grow up in certain neighborhoods, unless you're it's hard to.
Unless you're a tourist.
Yeah, usually, you know, you never leave your neighborhood much.
Yeah,
I mean, there were sections of my neighborhood before I became very influenced by the Beat Generation and a bit of wanderlust, although I'm not really a wanderlust person except in my mind. You know, I wandered from Avenue K and East 7th Street to Avenue J and East 16th Street, which actually was a long walk, and, you know, that's where I hung out when I was in my formative years, you know, at a pizza place, you know, in the neighborhood pizza place. And, you know, I did what a lot of kids did growing up in Brooklyn until I reached a certain age where I got totally fucked up and my whole life changed. But I spent a lot of time on the beach, which I still kind of don't do as much of, but still like to do, you know.
Yeah.
And Brooklyn, whether I like it or not, was very important to me, I guess, in a weird sense. And I'm not saying this to name drop because I don't know what it was like to a guy like Henry Miller, who also grew up in Brooklyn and managed to get out of America very early in life and then come back and never, you know, adorn the East Coast again, but stayed on the West Coast. So it's got to affect you, you know, wherever you come from and wherever you spend the formative part of your life.
I dreamed I was Van Gogh. Where
right, I dreamed
your
I
parents
was Van Gogh.
Were, and your brother and sister said, take care because you're out walking in the rain.
Right, that's very much childhood. Although it's a real dream and an imagined landscape of being on the Lower East Side and somehow in the dream, which also happens in dreams. Dreams are basically more about dislocation than location. And no one's ever said to me, why did you say in Brooklyn on the Lower East Side? Even people who love that poem never asked me that. And that's the dislocation factor of dreams. It's like if it's a place you are familiar with,
yeah.
It doesn't necessarily in the dream feel like it's where it really is. And in that dream, because I managed to write the poem as clearly as the dream, you know, I can feel specifically walking in the pouring rain, like I had mentioned to you,
yeah,
in what felt like the sidewalk around Tompkins Square Park on Avenue B, I think. And
but
and
you
in
felt
the dream feeling like I was in Brooklyn.
Yeah.
And remember distinctly walking down the steps and out of what was kind of like my parents' apartment, where I basically spent most of my childhood, the last apartment my parents had in Brooklyn. And I dream a lot about that place. Well, not a lot, maybe two or three times a year. And it's always dislocation because I know it's that place, but it's never exactly that place.
Yeah.
And
it was raining in the dream.
It was pouring rain. It was pouring rain.
Yeah.
And don't ask me why I went out without my shoes on.
Or stayed out there.
Yeah, or stayed out there, or why I dreamt I was Van Gogh, because that's really interesting. I very rarely have any memory of having dreams. I forget most of my dreams the minute I wake up, only have a memory of whether I thought it was an interesting or scary dream or not. And I don't remember ever really, like when I was very young, I had some dream about a red motor scooter, and it almost never left my mind.
Wow.
But I rarely, if ever, remember having a dream where I'm actually very aware that it's me in the dream, but I'm somebody else. So I must have really felt like I was Van Gogh in the dream. I mean, I don't know. I could only assume that because it was that's a very old poem, and the dream was probably even older. I don't know.
It's a really early poem, this one.
Well, early
on
poem
Incomplete
for me,
Directions. Yeah.
For that CD, there's maybe two pieces on there when the CD came out that were really old, and I read them because I really liked them.
Fantastic Freak Show. And the sons and lovers get together, and the snow's a long way off, and all we have is each other. Fantastic No Moon Night, and the jitterbugs at the bar haven't the heart to hang out, and the beat of the heart as it hangs out. Daughters and lovers blow islets of smog through each other, and the house is alive despite the drought. Phenomenal flakes of city night pulse through the blind slats, and I know that wherever I'll go, I'll carry the music inside me. Wherever I'll go, home will be carried inside me, beyond my words and this petty insanity that eats me up. Fantastic Freak Show. And lovers and lovers only have what is left of this night. No moon, no rain, no street, no stairway. And here at your feet, in the midst of the noise, by the edge of this town, I live where the sky is lowest.
If cars can fly, when we were meant talking about that, I don't really think of that as a childhood poem, you
know? Yeah, yeah.
Because I was walking down the street when I wrote that after being at a concert. Now I kind of remember. If cars can fly...
in that one you say, I know wherever I'll go, I'll carry the music inside me.
Right,
home, and I live where the sky is lowest.
Yeah, you know how I was telling you in the first conversation about giving away secrets of poetry?
Yeah.
Well, like I had mentioned about that poem, I wrote it in a place called the New Music Cafe, and a lot of the images in that poem were just written as I was listening to the music and looking out the window of the cafe, which had big windows.
Yeah.
And I can't tell you what all the images mean, but the whole idea of our whole life and being a fantastic freak show and the allusion to D.H. Lawrence with the sons and lovers get together and the snow's a long way off. I imagine I wrote it in summer, and I was looking out the window, and you know how sometimes you can look out the window even in a big city and kind of the horizon all of a sudden meets the pavement.
Definitely.
And New York is not like Paris. Paris has a very low sky and New York has a very high sky, except recently the sky has been getting kind of more like Paris, lower and lower. But sometimes there's just those instances where when you look at the landscape, I really feel that's what I meant, where like that instant, the sky, whenever I think about that line, I can only envision the sky and the concrete kind of meeting each other.
Yeah.
in a split geometric second. So,
leaving the Fassbinder film, I was greeted by the smell of burning leaves. From my childhood in Brooklyn, I told the woman beside me. We leave our homes at various stages of our lives. We return but never reside. We take with us our beliefs, our lack of. This is an old lesson in being human. In the small village, they tell Krishna the man, Krishna the pilgrim to be. If you leave us, at least leave us your shirt. If you don't want to come back for our sakes, well, you've got to. Oh, please, Mr. Krishna, come back for your shirt. Is this a request of the flesh or the spirit? Is this shirt, this cloth, these garments, symbol of the eternal or the earthly? Oh, the spirit made flesh, of course. The marriage of one to the other.